Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Science vs. Fiction. As always, I am joined by Dr. Steven DeGennaro. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Steven, I know we've covered time travel briefly in a previous episode, but it is such a fun and deep vein of science fiction, not just movies, of course, but novels and television and what have you. And everyone seems to love a good time travel story. And when it's one as well-crafted as either of the films that we're about to discuss, what is it about time travel that's so appealing?
I think that's it's pure science fiction in a lot of ways and is likely to remain so for a long, long time. There are a lot of science fiction concepts like rockets and going to the moon and, handheld devices that you can connect to giant information networks and,
robots.
Robots, things that, were science fiction 105 years ago. And
why don't you, before we delve into Back to the Future, which is, for my money and for most people's money, one of the best time travel movies ever made, explain briefly why time travel could never work.
Well, so I'm going to repeat a little bit of my shtick from our live episode. If you guys haven't listened to that, you should go back and listen. But the gist of it is, we are all time travelers. We are all traveling into the future at a rate of 1 minute per minute.
Whoa.
So the difficult part of time travel is the traveling either into the future at a different rate or traveling into the past. Now, traveling into the future is one of those things that is science fiction for now and probably will remain so for a long time, but we understand how you could do it. You can get on a rocket ship and you can fly somewhere really, really, really fast and then fly back really, really, really fast. And when you get back, a lot more time will have passed on Earth than will have passed for you. And so in that sense, you are going into the future.
If we wanted to use a cinematic reference, that would be Planet of the Apes, kind of.
Yes. But traveling into the past is one of those things that is beyond any – not just beyond any current understanding, but very, very unlikely – based on everything that we know about how the universe functions. Now, there's a lot of stuff that we don't know, but...
All right, well, let me ask you this. I'm going to raise my hand in Time Travel 101 and say, Dr. D, because I wouldn't know how to pronounce your last name, so I would just call you Dr. D. Why is it that if we have been able to extrapolate, in theory, how we could go forward in time using a rocket and then, coming back and much time has passed, why could we not use the reverse principles to come up with some kind of reverse time travel theorem?
Well, there is no reverse principles. Time moves in one direction. It is in
Does it, Steven?
Yeah. I mean, again, everything that we know about the universe says that time moves in one direction. And it is, in some sense, a mystery. We don't fully understand. Like, most laws are reversible in time. Like, you could reverse time and the physical laws
right.
would reverse and things would do the same thing backwards as they do forward, but there are some that don't.
Your guy in the rocket theory being able to travel forward in time makes sense because he's not doing anything to the timeline. He's doing something to himself. He's basically putting himself in pause up in outer space and then coming back.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, like, he is, we know from relativity, and that's a thing that has been experimentally verified over and over and over again. That if you travel fast, your clock moves slower. And the why of that is fascinating and difficult to understand. And it has to do with the fact that the speed of light is constant no matter what speed you're traveling. If you look at a beam of light, it will always be traveling at the speed of light, even if you are traveling at 9/10 of the speed of light. And that's a weird paradox that's opens a whole big can of worms that's hard to, wrap your brain around. But
no kidding.
That, in consequence, you can travel into the future at a faster rate than 1 minute per minute. But as far as traveling into the past, probably not going to happen.
All right. Well, Steven, we are about to travel into the past, specifically 1985. That's right. The summer of 1985, and this movie hit, we knew right off the bat that it was going to be fun. But seeing Back to the Future, and I want to say opening night, but it might have been second night. It was definitely opening weekend, Friday or Saturday night. Seeing this movie was like watching a Rocky movie or something. People were laughing at the exact right moments, and then at the end, cheering, not just when George punches Biff, but when Marty pops back up at the end and starts playing the guitar all triumphantly, and then again when he gets back, when he get, the whole thing with Doc, when he's able to actually travel back. Oy, oy, oy. This movie was so much fun to watch with the original audience back in 85, and this movie, I would love to be able to nitpick it and say this, that doesn't hold up. I think it's as good now as it ever was. I don't think it has anything cringy that a lot of these films do. I mean, there's mildly cringy stuff because he flirts with his own mother a little bit inadvertently. So that's slightly cringy.
But they're aware of how cringy that is. That's not accidentally cringy.
Yes. That is what was just as cringy in 1985, and it's done as a PG-13 dirty joke. It is not done as an R-rated dirty joke, and you know, that's appreciated because there is that aspect of the film has to be addressed in some way.
Right.
So I thought they handled it in a fun and classy way. But man, this movie is so much fun. And I'm going to tell one quick anecdote, and then I want to turn it over to you. When I was in college, I took a general writing course, and they broke it down by, you know, months. We did screenplays for one of the final months or one of the final, you know, sections. And he said, every screenwriting professor or class will tell you, read Chinatown, Robert Town, Chinatown, read it, Chinatown. You got to read it. But don't do that. Read a screenplay that's as clever as Chinatown and as layered and as dense and as brilliant, but a lot more fun. Read Back to the Future. It is a perfect screenplay. It is so much fun to read. So this movie is as much fun as it ever was. So much good stuff. I could talk for hours about it, but who wants to hear that? I want to hear Steven.
I mean, I love this movie too. I love everything about it. I think, yeah, you're right. It holds up. It's, you know, it's a brilliantly constructed screenplay that you just kind of sit there. Like when you think about it, when you analyze it, like you just kind of are slack-jawed in awe of how they managed to like pull this off.
It could be so complicated, but it's not. It's so simple.
It is complicated in a lot of ways, but it lays out everything brilliantly, you know, in terms of exposition and in terms of the audience being able to follow it. In my case, an audience that was 7 years old when it came out. I did not see it in the theater. I did see it. I remember very distinctly the first time I saw it, which was on television at a friend of my parents' house. Like somebody just kind of put it on, like where there was a big party with like adults and kids, you know, one of those, you know, barbecue type things or whatever. And somebody put it on in the kids' room and we all sat down and watched it and we were all just kind of like, holy crap, this is amazing. And, you know, at seven, I was able to completely follow everything that was going on, even if I didn't always get a lot of the nuance of, you know, I don't think I knew a whole lot about the 1950s. Speaking of which, for those that don't know, and it's very unlikely that anybody listening to this podcast is not going to be familiar with this movie, but basic plot synopsis, Marty McFly, played by Michael J. Fox, is friends with a wacky scientist, played by Christopher Lloyd, who has invented a machine that can go back in time. And Marty McFly accidentally transports himself back to 1955 to the week that his parents met one another, which also happened to be the week that the time machine was invented. And his shenanigans in the past mess up the timeline such that his parents may not get together and he might never actually be born if he can't manage to repair the paradox.
I think the original title was Marty McFly, Repair the Paradox.
It's a great title too. I mean, like, you know, it's the title is another one of those things that's like, I knew the title obviously because it was a hit, but also because like it's back to the future, but the future is in front. So how can we go back to the future?
Yep.
And it's just it's that same sort of cleverness. Cause you can imagine this movie being called like Time Warp or something like that. And
the teen from the future.
Yeah. Or some, you know,
what is dated? I think maybe the Libyans, that reference that, I mean, and that characterization might be a bit dated. The DeLorean, do young kids get why the DeLorean is a weird choice for a time machine?
I don't know if I got that in 1985. I doubt a whole lot of kids did because I doubt a whole lot of kids knew what the heck a DeLorean was until they saw this movie. I don't think it was something that was like, had permeated pop culture or had permeated, you know, kids' consciousness or even maybe adult consciousness. It was kind of a weird niche sort of like, oh, isn't that a funny looking car that they only ever sold like 1,000 of them or something.
Yeah, so. It's a designer car, and they don't have to explain it. The fact that Marty is like incredulous and is and recognizes it is like, oh, okay, it's a weird car that most of us have never heard of. Got it.
Yeah, but it looks like a time machine, and that's the, you know, like clearly why they chose it. But yeah, I mean, it's a perfect choice. And
I mean, and like the joke wouldn't be as good if it was a Ferrari or something.
And that to me typifies this movie to a T. Like they made every choice right, and that's the thing about I love about the movies that I love is that you go through them and you realize like, okay, casting check. And, you know, in the case of this movie, that was an especially ballsy sort of feat because, you know, as most people probably know, Eric Stoltz was originally cast as Marty McFly. They shot with him for like a couple weeks and Zemeckis realized that it wasn't working and fired him and replaced him with Michael J. Fox. And
could you imagine doing that? You're a director. Can you imagine?
No, I know. I can't imagine, A, having that luxury and having the studio go along with it, but like realizing, okay, this person is not the right person for this role. I made a mistake. And now I can either go on and make a movie that's kind of ho-hum and probably won't make any money, or I can beg the studio to let me reshoot all of that stuff.
You got to respect that call because I love Eric Stoltz. I mean, he's low-key a character actor who's reliable in everything. He's great. But if you're watching your dailies and your image in your head is, no, Marty McFly has to, like, ooze likability. He has to, like, be jaunty and bouncy and wise-ass.
Kind of nerdy and a little bit stammery and a little bit, you know, like, nervous. And
yeah, and you know, Eric Stoltz is, I could just see it, Eric Stoltz is a little more stoic. He's a little more mature. He's a little more quiet and calm, and you don't see him being bouncy and energetic and incredulous. It must have been horrible. Could you imagine how bad he must have felt? Eric Stoltz, God.
He's gone on record as saying that he agrees with the decision, and now you know how much of that is politics or whatever. You know, and he's gone on to have a pretty awesome career, so he probably doesn't have very many regrets in that regard. If he had, like, faded into obscurity, then maybe, you know? But it's not like he just disappeared off the radar after that.
Yep.
But as I was saying, like, you know, Marty McFly feels like your kid brother. You know, as played by Michael J. Fox. And that is so essential to your sympathy for him and your you know, the charm that he exudes. He's not smarmy. He's not,
some
you know,
people, and therefore some actors, just have an innate likability and then also know how to use that innate likability when they're actors. And Michael J. Fox, if he wasn't an actor and you just met him behind you in line at Burger King, you'd be like, oh, what a nice guy. He just seems like a nice guy.
Yeah, yeah. Like Tom Hanks is another one
exactly,
of those guys.
Exactly. And that's why a lot of those actors, you know, are really good at, you know, tapping into the good side. But also it's so much fun when they go dark and nasty because you're like, oh.
Yep.
Tom Hanks, dark and nasty. That's not right.
Right. But he also doesn't feel like a hero right off the bat. And that, you know, is a thing that I think a lot of movies nowadays, especially mass entertainment movies, have a harder time with, you know, where like, you know, from minute one, a lot of times, you know, because it's, you know, one of the Chris's or Robert Downey Jr. or whatever, where you're like, all right, this dude's the hero. Like, and you know he's a hero from frame one. With Marty McFly, like, he's kind of a dork, and he's again, he's nervous a lot of times, and he definitely does not seem like the person who can, like, handle the kind of stress that he's going to be put under over the course of this movie and come out, you know, on top. And so you're rooting for him because he's an underdog, really.
Yep. And there's just so many clever moments. I remember clear as day the idea that he's bringing in, like, Star Wars iconography into the 1955 setting and using that to his advantage. I just was so tickled by that. I mean, I just – Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis wrote this, and they probably – as I mean, it must have been rewritten 1,000 times, but when they nailed – when they came up with something like that, being able to use Darth Vader in 1955 as not only a joke but as a good plot device, they must have just been like, yes – yes, like, I must be so great to write something that fun.
So speaking of which, you know, in terms of storytelling, and again, in terms of, like, all cylinders clicking with, you know, casting and production design and you know, in terms of the car and,
oh, the score.
And story decisions, the score. Yep.
It has that John Williams playfulness, but it is, of course, the great Alan Silvestri.
Yeah, I mean, that theme is one of the iconic movie theme songs of all time. Like, everybody, you hum that to somebody and they know exactly what movie it belongs to.
Shot by the great Dean Cundey, who did a lot of films for John Carpenter.
And and so, like, all of it works. And again, there are a lot of little storytelling touches. You learn everything that you need to know about Doc Brown in the opening montage 10 minutes before you ever even see him on screen.
Yep. Yep.
Like, you see where he lives, you see the kind of things that he builds and how he, you know, he has this lab with these things that don't really work the way that they're supposed to work. And
photos on his wall.
And, you know, he's been neglecting his dog for who knows how long. And so you know Doc Brown immediately purely through visuals without anybody ever telling you anything about him, without ever even seeing him on screen, you know what Doc Brown is. And, you know, and then when he does finally appear on screen, it's Christopher Lloyd firing on all cylinders.
Wonderful.
In a role that you cannot imagine a single other actor in the history of cinema ever playing that role.
Yeah, it's a great performance because he has to be Marty's friend.
Right.
He also has to be a mad scientist. But he also has to be likable because he has a lot of exposition to give off. So, yep. You know what I mean? He's irresponsible and maybe slightly dangerous because of what he's doing with these terrorists and the plutonium and whatever. But he's a good guy. You know, he has good intentions.
Yeah, but in a likable sort of way, exactly. He's not mean, you know. And you buy, I mean, you know, when you stop and think about it, and people have criticized the movie for this, and I think they're wrong. But, you know, the friendship is certainly an odd one.
Yes.
You have this older, weird scientist dude. And then you have Marty McFly, who is a 24-year-old playing a 17-year-old.
Not weird at all. I can't tell you. I did not have a friend like Marty McFly or like Doc Brown when I was 17. But you know what we did have when I would be riding my bike down the street? Oh, there's Mrs. Jones. Her husband passed away last year. Hey, Mrs. Jones.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, you get everything you need to know about their relationship, you know, in those first couple scenes. He's there to feed his dog. But, you know, we see what Marty gets out of the relationship, which is he gets to, you know, fiddle around with these things and plug his guitar into this amazing amplifier, which I'll have more to say about in a second. And, you know, Doc Brown obviously has him come over to feed the dog. And so they have this weird sort of thing. To me, it feels almost like that dynamic that I had with a couple of my favorite teachers, you know, where you wouldn't go to their house necessarily, but like, you know, when you're in school, you might end up like hanging out in their classroom during
yeah.
a free period just to, you know, shoot the crap about science or geeky stuff or whatever else, you know.
Aside from the key aspect of the film, the time travel itself, let's talk about some of the tertiary and little science on the side. I believe you wanted to discuss the giant speaker.
Yeah. So, you know, he plugs into this giant amplifier with has this, like, I don't know, like 8-foot speaker. That would, I mean, you know, I say this as a guitar player as much as a scientist. And an audiophile, that speaker would not be a very good speaker to play guitar out of. It, you know, it would be loud probably, but a speaker that big is only going to be able to reproduce low frequency sounds because it has to move this giant cone back and forth, and that takes time, and that therefore means low frequencies, which is why you see bass amplifiers usually have big speakers, but your tweeters have these little tiny speakers because to do high frequency sounds, you need smaller speakers. So it wouldn't be a very good guitar amplifier. It also would not – there is no amount of power that you could put into a speaker like that would generate enough wind to blast you out of your sneakers across the room. But I will say this. I mean, that moment is iconic and awesome, and, you know, it's certainly not a thing that as a child I would have ever thought about. It's so weirdly unexpected, and yet – and the minute it happens, you're like, well, yeah, of course that was going to happen.
Yeah, it's a good cartoon gag because, you know, he looks so self-assured. And then it also tells you, all right, he likes guitars. And it also gives you a little bit of insight into his character in that, you know, he's curious and a little foolhardy and messing with things, playing, not with bad intent, but playing with things he probably shouldn't play with.
Yeah. And it sets up a funny little joke later on when Doc Brown calls him while he's sitting there in the wreckage of his apartment. And he's like, oh, by the way, don't plug your guitar into the amplifier. I'm having some problems with it overloading. And he's like, oh, yeah, sure.
So many dovetail jokes. You could just see, well, like I said, the script must have been rewritten 1,000 times. Back in the day, the joke about Twin Pines Mall being Lone Pine Mall. Like, that was explained on the internet, but back in the day, oh, you only caught that if you saw the movie 3 or 4 times.
Or somebody told you about it, and then you go, like, my older brother had to tell me about that gag, and then the next time I watched the movie, I was like, you know, because they don't foreground it. You know?
Oh, he went back in time and smashed one of the pine trees, and now it's Lone Pine instead of Twin Pines.
And the fact that they don't hit you on the head with it, what makes it so good.
There are so many little jokes. How about the joke about Lorraine's brother being in the playpen, but then being in prison later?
Well, so I will say about that scene. That scene struck me this time for whatever reason, and it never has before. That scene struck me this time as being
a little cruel.
Occasionally, sort of. Occasionally. Well, so number one, that turns out to not really make any. It doesn't make a whole lot of difference to the plot of the movie.
No, it seems like there might have been a third callback to that character who's never really called back again. Yeah.
But it also, that whole scene as a whole thing, the scene around the dinner table when he's eating, you know, with his mother and his grandfather and grandmother, like it felt like there was, they hit a little bit too hard on the like, oh, haha, let's make a joke that people in the future will understand that we don't know that we're saying a thing that will become true in the future,
right,
sort of thing.
Well, but then there's the rerun joke, and that one is great because it's something that somebody would just, oh, it's a rerun. You know, and
but there's, I can't remember which one it was, but there's one right at the, like towards the end of that scene where they're like, oh, I can't imagine such and such ever John F. Kennedy. Who's that? Like, it just felt a little bit too much. Like,
yeah. Well,
but just a hair, a soupçon, over the line.
A whisker. Yeah. I get it. Yeah. But you know, I mean, not to be a jerk about it, but like, if you're telling five jokes, you want to tell one that's like a 10%er. You want to tell two or three that's like, or a 70%er. And then you want to tell one that's like a 98%er that everybody
Well,
will
that's
get.
The thing is that's like almost every joke in that scene, the punchline is ha ha ha. These people, we know what the future is going to hold and they don't, you know? And so like it started to feel a bit repetitive, but whatever. Let's, you know, we're starting to feel a bit repetitive. Let's move on.
Yes, you are. I'm kidding. All right. So other science.
Science. Right. So plutonium.
As a fuel.
Is not a red liquid. Of course, it's a fuel. I mean, plutonium is what is in nuclear reactors. It's in nuclear bombs.
No, I mean, like, as a fuel for an automobile.
Yeah. I mean, plutonium powers nuclear submarines. It could power an automobile just fine. It powers satellites, Voyager 1 and 2, you know, the Voyager spacecraft both contain a little bit of plutonium, and a little bit goes a long way. And as the plutonium decays, it gives off heat, and that heat gets turned into power. And so the Voyager spacecraft, we're still talking to. Decades later, they have now left the solar system, and we're still in communication with them because they had a tiny little bit of plutonium in them powering them. And, you know, any battery that you had stuck on a spacecraft 40, 50 years ago would long have since corroded and died. But, you know, plutonium. So, yeah, plutonium absolutely as a portable source of a whole lot of energy can't be beat.
Did you know that, generally speaking, plutonium will exhibit 6 allotropes and 4 oxidation states?
Yes, as a matter of fact. I was aware of that.
I mean, I wasn't.
Some people don't think it's only 5 allotropes, but they're incorrect.
Well, I personally believe that it reacts with carbon, nitrogen, silicon, halogens, and hydrogen.
Well, there you go.
Which is the one I'm wrong on.
Plutonium is a metal. So, you know, raw plutonium looks like a chunk of metal.
It's an actinide metal, if you want to be specific.
I don't know if it would look like it was glowing or not. It is. My point is, it is not a red liquid, which is how they portray it in the movie.
No.
It also, that you know, they put on those suits to protect themselves, supposedly, from the plutonium. Those are not radiation suits. Those are like the hazmat suits that we saw from, like, Outbreak. They might be good against diseases.
Right.
Keeping, you know, small particles of diseases, but they are completely useless against radiation. It's a good production design touch, not scientifically accurate.
Well, according to the Wikipedia article that I was just stealing from, plutonium looks a lot like mercury, the element, not the planet.
Yeah. One of the things I want to talk about, I am fascinated by the physics behind the car needing to be traveling at 88 miles per hour.
Okay, aside from there needing to be a kinetic plot device, which is, yeah, we got to get out of here. And a fast car hitting almost 90 miles an hour is a really great visual device for let's get out of here.
Oh, it's great.
Okay, yeah, but now we're going to, Stephen, we're going to delve into the physics or the science of the 88 miles per hour.
Yeah, well, so I'm fascinated by it in part because I can't even say whether it's good or bad because I don't understand what exactly about the 88 miles per hour is actually doing anything. So we know this thing is powered by plutonium. Plutonium, as I said, is a, you know, an element that packs a large amount of power in a very small package, but you need quite a bit of it in order for that energy to actually do anything really sort of appreciable. What's interesting to me about the 88 miles per hour, right? We talked a little bit earlier about relativity. So when we're talking about the thing moving 88 miles an hour, well, the Earth is spinning at, you know, 1,000 miles an hour. So that car was already traveling 1,000 miles an hour just by virtue of the fact that it's on a rotating Earth, and then it's traveling, you know, on the Earth around the sun. And so that leads me to believe that it must have something to do with the tires moving at 88 miles per hour. It can't be, because all speed is relative, right? So it's relative speed with the surface of the Earth having some sort of physical impact onto whether or not the time machine could work seems implausible or difficult to understand how that would even be a thing. But by the same token, if you're talking about, okay, well, its wheels need to be turning as fast as 88 miles an hour, well, then in that case, it wouldn't need to actually be moving 88 miles an hour. You could just sit it on a stand and spin the wheels at 88 miles an hour and let the lightning hit you. So that also doesn't make any sense. So what I'm saying is that from a purely physics point of view, from a purely scientific logic point of view, the 88 miles an hour thing doesn't make any sense. But it doesn't make any sense in the same way that we've talked about on the other time travel episode where the Earth moves. The Earth has moved quite considerably between 1955 and 1985. And so...
Right. Could one not say... Or could we not say that, like, time after time has certain rules about the time machine that don't make sense? The little rod has to be in it for it to work, is kind of their 88 miles per hour.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah. What I'm saying, though, is just like, you know, one of the problems with time travel in almost any movie is this idea that the Earth will have moved in the whatever time it is that you're jumping, the Earth will have moved, which means that if you went to the same point in space, if you can even say that there's such a thing as the same point in space, which is a concept that in and of itself may not make scientific sense. In other words, basically, if you jump back in time, what are the odds or what is the mechanism by which your car appears at the exact same spot on the Earth, even though that's an entirely different spot now in the, like, galaxy?
Right. You don't just need a machine that will take you back in time. You need a machine that will extrapolate your relative position, too.
Right.
Because otherwise, if I went 100 years in the past, period, I might show up in the middle of a building somewhere in the middle of Australia.
Or you might just end up in deep space is the most likely thing.
Deep space, exactly. So yeah, you would need something that not only takes you back in time, but also figures out your relative position in the past and puts you there.
There are little things about that too, especially in that last scene, because one of the conceits of that last scene is that, you know, they don't really quite have enough road. And so the minute that he hits that clock tower, if he doesn't zap out, he's going to crash into the buildings because there's a bend in the road. Well, he then appears in that same spot in 1985, and those buildings are still there, but somehow he manages to swerve or stop in time to hit the buildings in 1985 that he would have hit in 1955 if he'd have kept going.
Yes, when he goes back from 55 to 85, in 85 he should logically plow straight into City Hall and die in a horrible fiery wreck. Yes, I hate to say it, but I think you are right there.
It's also difficult, well, you know, so talking about these things and the difficulty of, like, okay, well, we have to, you know, we have to get moving at 88 miles per hour, we have the plutonium, we have, you know, these complicated equations of motion and whatever else to get the thing back in the exact same spot. And, you know, earlier on in the movie, we saw that Doc Brown was barely capable of building this Rube Goldberg machine to feed his dog. It's again, absolutely part of the movie's charm that there's this sense that Doc just sort of like accidentally invented a time machine.
No, and there's also the idea that somebody who is brilliant, because he is a goofball, but he's also brilliant, when he's just kind of dicking around making a dog feeder, who cares? But when it's about something important and somebody that he cares about, he's going to fix it. And that's just good character writing.
I'm just talking, yes. I'm talking about like his having invented it in the first place.
Yeah, how he fell off his toilet and...
No, well, I'm just saying like, you know, at some point he perfected this, in 1985, he perfected this time machine that actually works. And we see it work for the first time on screen because that's his first test of it, is to send his dog Einstein 1 minute into the future. So there's this sense of like, you know, there's this moment, this great moment with Christopher Lloyd where it looks like he's as surprised as Marty is that this thing actually worked.
Yeah.
Because he's used to his stuff not working. Because then again, when Marty does go back into the past, when he first meets Doc in the past, Doc is trying to do this weird mind reading thing, and he's built this helmet and he's trying to figure out who Marty is, and he gets it all wrong. And so clearly, like, most of his inventions, the implication of all of the other stuff is that most of his inventions don't work. And the fact that this one does.
He's a crackpot, yeah.
And it's, again, I don't think it's because he's dumb. I think it's because he has these sort of big ideas and, you know, he goes for them, and most of them were destined to not work in the first place. And somehow or another, this time travel one actually pans out. And I think it's fascinating. Just, you know, from a character point of view.
It is a beautiful movie. Why don't you, real quick, define this word for us. What does the word capacitor mean?
When you add the word flux in front of it, it becomes difficult to parse. A capacitor in the sense of an electronic system is a device that stores up charge. So you send a bunch of electrons into this thing and it stores them all up together, and which essentially makes it be able to store energy. And then at some point you decide to, you discharge the capacitor and you release all that energy at once. And so what it allows you to do in electronics is it allows you to store up a bunch of energy over a long period of time and then release it over a very, very short period of time.
So one of those portable phone batteries could be considered a capacitor, because you fill it with a charge, you take it with you, and then you unload the charge into your phone.
No. So a battery is a battery, and it charges it. It's a very different sort of principle. A capacitor is an electronic component that, again, the key to why we have capacitors and how they function is that you can build up this charge over a fairly long period of time and then discharge it very, very rapidly, and thus generate a lot more power over a very, very short period of time than you would have been able to from just the raw electricity coming in. So it's a little bit like, you know, if you built a little bulwark and you pile a bunch of snow against it on the side of a mountain, and then when you pull a string and the gate flips down, then all of that snow comes down the mountain at once a lot faster than you could kind of, you know, mm-hmm. dump it down the mountain manually. So that's kind of the basic idea of it. I don't know, like flux and capacitor together.
Well, that was the thing. I was going to ask you to identify, to define the words separately, right, and then to put them together, because it sounds great. They are two scientific words. Flux means what? A change in something, right? There is flux.
There are a couple of different ways that we use that term in science. Generally, yes, it has something to do with a change in things. You know, flux, things are in flux, we say, you know, non-scientifically. Flux is also a measure in astronomy. It's a measure of how much light is passing through a given surface area. And so it's used in that broad sense as well in other scientific things, but, you know, it's about something flowing through something else or something changing. Yeah. So I suppose in that sense, it is, you know, it's storing up a bunch of temporal energy, you know, that is in flux, and then it releasing it all at once when you hit 88 miles an hour, and that allows you to suddenly boom, zap into the past. Oh.
My favorite question about the flux capacitor, and I know you want to talk about this, 1.21 what?
It's funny, because if you remade this movie in 2020, nobody would not know how to pronounce that, right? Because, you know, we don't, you know, my computer doesn't have 8 gigabytes of RAM.
Now, was that a mistake on the screenwriter's part, or was that written because he was not a smart enough scientist to know that it's pronounced gigawatts?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I don't know if it's even in the script. My guess has always been that, like, it says GIGAWATTS, and either Christopher Lloyd or Robert Zemeckis thought that gigawatts was how you pronounced it. Back then, giga was not the computers that we had at most kilobytes, you know, which is 1,000 bytes. Mega is 1,000,000.
Oh, yeah.
Giga is 1,000,000,000. And so, like, we were all long, 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 long way from giga ever really sort of entering into the vocabulary of normal everyday people.
That's a great explanation. I'm still curious if somebody on set said, it's technically gigawatts. And they went, yeah, but he said it and it made everyone laugh. So we're keeping it.
Yeah, no, exactly. It may very well have been like somebody said it wrong and they were like, that's funnier as gigawatts.
Or if they honestly it was an honest mistake and they just went ahead. Like, that was it. Yeah. I'm curious. But either way, it is hilarious.
A lightning strike, incidentally, is absolutely, you know, they can range over a very wide range of energies or power. Watts is a measure of power. But, you know, 1.21 gigawatts is certainly within the range of, so somebody did at least that much research to figure out how much energy is in a bolt of lightning and chose a number that, you know, fit with that.
Is he, Bob Gaylor or Zemeckis or somebody made a phone call to, you know, MIT or something and said, all right, how much energy does a lightning bolt give off? And somebody went, about, or the email, probably mailed them a letter that said about 1.21 gigawatts. And they went, Thank you, sir, or madam, and that was it.
But they looked it up in the encyclopedia. Yeah, they looked it up in the encyclopedia, and the encyclopedia said, you know, 1 to 2 gigawatts. And so they, you know, to me, I would imagine that they came up with the 1.21 on their own. Just, I mean, one of the basic principles of comedy writing is that specific is more funny than general.
Yeah.
So if it had been 1 gigawatt, yeah, that's not particularly funny, but 1.21 gigawatts.
Right, right.
Now it becomes just sort of a funny thing. And gigawatt sounds funnier than gigawatt.
Yep.
Anyway, so I got two more quick science things. One of them is a medical thing. One of them is a physics thing. First of all, if you hit somebody with your car and they were unconscious, would you take them into your house?
No.
Or would you take them to a hospital?
Well, I mean, we're also, that really does play into the 1955 aspect, which is we have these halcyon images of, well, of course, if you struck somebody with your car, you would immediately, nurse them and help take them back to health.
Right.
And, you know, like it kind of
or
feeds
you'd call
into,
a doctor. You'd bring him in, you might bring him into your house, but then you'd call your doctor and the doctor would come to your house.
Right. Like. And I always thought it kind of fed into this clever screenwriting thing of, oh, the story that your parents told are always idolized. They're always perfected. Like, you didn't really take him into your house and nurse him. You probably sat on the curb with him and said, hey, are you okay? You know, there's, but no, that's actually how it happened, apparently, in the past.
And, you know, if that did happen and you knocked somebody unconscious and they were asleep for 9 hours,
that's bad.
They're not sleeping anymore. They're in a coma.
Yeah,
and
concussed.
They need serious medical attention.
They didn't know much about concussion technology in the 50s.
After
man.
The first 2 or 3 hours, you might start going, well, you know what? This guy is still unconscious. Maybe we should get him to a doctor. But no, they just let him sleep for 9 hours and he wakes up and he has no memory loss, which, again, if you got knocked in the head enough to knock you unconscious for 9 hours, you would not remember most of the day that led up to that. So it would be an interesting alternate version of this movie where he wakes up and he literally doesn't remember how he got back into the past.
Oh my God, yeah. Marty McFly with amnesia would make the movie too tension, too much tension. I wouldn't be able to handle it. I have a medical question.
Okay.
Since you brought up medical. Would you suffer any ill effects if your convertible with you in it was completely covered in horse manure?
I imagine there's potentially diseases in the horse manure, but we put that stuff on our food. Like, you know, we shovel it into the plants that we grow to eat. That's how we fertilize them. So that's why it was in the truck.
That's literally why. That's why I never eat vegetables.
Oh yeah, sure. That's why.
Yep.
Yeah, and then so the other scientific thing. Was that, you know, and this is, again, it's a great, great moment in the movie, but I think everybody knows this. Electricity moves inside the wires, not outside the wires. And if you were actually like holding onto a wire where, you know, if a lightning struck a thing and you were holding onto the wire and that electricity was moving along the outside of that wire and through your body at 1.21 gigawatts, pretty sure you'd be like dead 10 or 20 times over.
Your insides would be barbecued before your outsides.
It's a great visual, but yeah, it's like, wait a second, that doesn't make any sense. Why is the lightning traveling down the outside of the wire? The whole point of them building that wire was because you want a wire and because electricity goes through metal.
Oh yeah. Well, you as this is now, the, you know, scientist versus filmmaker. I come to you and say, all right, Stephen, you have in the script that the lightning hits the rod, goes into the box, the wire vibrates, and then boom. But we need this on the outside, and we need it to look shocking. Right. We need it to look exciting. Right. And you'd look at it and go, okay, yeah.
Yeah, and also we need it to travel at a slow enough rate of speed that we can see it moving across the screen, which is another thing you would not be able to do because it would basically be moving at the speed of light.
Right, and that's also the same reason why you need the city hall there. It's a suspense. It's a finite moment. They have to lock the wires before the electricity hits, and he has to hit 88 before he plows into the city hall. It's all clockwork.
Yep.
It's beautiful.
Let's take a moment also to consider the fact that they know that the clock stopped at 10:04, but there's not a second hand on that clock. So, like, it could have happened anywhere between 10:04 and 10:05,
which is a lot of time if you're trying to be
which
precise.
Which is a full minute if you're trying to, like, get the exact moment that you hit 88 miles an hour. They got very lucky that the lightning struck the clock at exactly 10, like, the minute that the hand clicked over.
Right,
to 10:04.
No, yeah, at 10:00 instead of 10:00:14. I don't know.
Yeah. So they got lucky like that.
Yep. Oh, it's such a, so much fun to watch. And if you've never seen it with a crowd, and even if that only means your family, watch this movie with a crowd, because it plays your emotions like a flute, and it's so much fun that you just play along. Entertainment value, A+. Movies do not get more entertaining than this. And we didn't give enough attention to the cast, but I also want to throw some extra love to Leia Thompson, who gives a wonderfully funny performance. She's asked to play kind of clueless, but you empathize with her cluelessness, and she's so sweet and funny. Tom Wilson as Biff, freaking great. And of course, Lloyd and Michael J. Fox, just wonderful. And to all involved in with this movie, well done. You've given the world a real treasure. Thank you.
Yeah, it's an A, by any measure. It's a great movie. It's, you know, a movie I've seen dozens of times before. It's a movie that I love returning to. And I will say this time through, I noticed something that I had never noticed before, which is that Scott Weinberg appears in this movie. And I did not realize that you were in it. And you've kept it secret all these years. And I'm, you know, just sort of shocked that you built a time machine, went back in time so that you could play the homeless guy on the bench at the end of the movie.
Did you look like me?
In 1985. Yeah, did you not notice?
Nope.
He kind of looks like you if you haven't shaved for a couple of days and you just let your hair go.
Well, yeah, you should see me right now, man. Well, we're going to move on from 1985's best time travel movie to 1989's best time travel movie. It probably wasn't expected to be a big hit or a pop cultural phenomenon. It was probably just meant to be a mild hit and find a big audience on cable and VHS. And because it is such a well-made and amiable and entertaining comedy adventure sci-fi movie, it became a global sensation. It spawned a sequel, and there is a third sequel on the way. Let's talk about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
This was one of the handful of movies that if you'd have come to me when I was 13 years old or 14, 15 years old, pretty much any time in high school, I could have recited the entire movie to you from beginning to end. Like, I could have sat there and just talked along with it the whole way through because I had seen it so, so many times. It's one of the first movies that I really, really remember anticipating. And I've been racking my brain trying to figure out, like, I saw a very brief, like a little like half page article about it in like an Entertainment Weekly or like a Teen Beat magazine or something like that. You know, just a brief synopsis of this movie that was going to be coming out this summer. And I was just like immediately like, holy crap, that sounds like exactly the kind of thing that my little 13-year-old boy self would absolutely love. And I did. And I remember watching it over and over and over and over. And I haven't watched it nearly as much as an adult as I did then. And so I was a little bit nervous going back to it this time because I was worried that it wouldn't hold up. And I was, especially after the first 5 or 10 minutes, where I was like, okay, you're right. They're amiable. They're funny, you know, but it is definitely aimed at a teenage audience. But then they get to the part where Rufus shows up and they start with the time machine, and I was just transported back to that feeling of joy that I felt when I was 13 years old watching this for the first time, and the whole rest of the movie, big smile on my face and just tears in my eyes for like that feeling of the way that movies can just like impact your life in a way that just feels meaningful. And this is one of those movies I think that really made me want to be a filmmaker.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's not always some, you know, powerful Oscar-winning important movie. It's very often a fun little genre film or a horror film or a comedy or something that just makes you feel good. And then when you come back to it many years later and it still says something to you, you know, that's a movie that's real love. That's when you fall for a movie. Of course, like a lot of good comedies, this one is what you'd call a high concept pitch, which is What if two stoner teenagers had access to a time machine and they used it to go back in time to do their history report?
Are they stoners, though? The movie never...
Well, they don't... It's a PG-13 back in the day, so they're kind of... They don't ever show them smoking weed, but I think it's clear to anybody that they're...
Well, I would say that they're slacker teenagers. Okay, yeah, all right. I don't think there's anything in the movie that implies that they're stoners.
Fair enough. They're like, you're right.
Again, they're pitched... They're older than 13, but they act like 13-year-olds. And to me, you know, I don't know about you. You're more of a pothead than I am. But like, you know, kids at 13 smoking pot is a very different thing than kids at 15 or 18 or 17 smoking pot. So I don't know. Like, to me, they just kind of were amiable goofballs that were kind of slackers and not too bright, but good-hearted. And even this time through, like I didn't get any sense of like, oh, they're stoners.
But like say stoners in spirit.
Yeah.
You keep mentioning Rufus as played by the late brilliant George Carlin, who had an interesting, if not altogether successful film career, showed up in small roles in a lot of stuff. He's really funny in a movie called Outrageous Fortune with Shelley Long and with Bette Midler, but not exactly a huge movie career. And this is one of his highlights because he gets to be kind of like the goofy Obi-Wan character.
Yeah.
On one hand, he's an exposition machine, but he's also so cool and commanding as like their wizened old, you know, instructor that whenever he pops up on the screen, you're just happy to see him again. He's great.
Yeah.
And you can't say enough about the performances by Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves. They are together and separately. They know these characters and they are simplistic characters, but there's also a real warmth to them. Towards each other and just towards their demeanor. They might be dumb. They might be irresponsible, and you know, you wouldn't maybe want them to be your kids, but they're good guys. They're not dicks. And that's a key aspect to this movie, is that they are good guys.
Yeah, and you want them to succeed, you know, right from the beginning. And again, I imagine if you're 40 years old watching this movie for the first time, you might have a different opinion of them, but certainly as a 13-year-old or a teenager of any age.
It's cleverly written because there's a lot of smart behind their dumb actions, you know what I mean? Like,
well, there's a lot of smart in the script as well. Yeah, and there are some moments where they have some... They're not dumb, right? That's the thing, I think, is that they aren't dumb. They are...
Innocent? Naive?
Yes, they are innocent. They are slackers. They don't really want to, you know, they have big dreams and they don't, you know, they're not interested in school and that kind of learning at all. But they have a sort of shrewdness to them when they need to, you know, typified by the scene late in the movie where... Which we talked about in the Time After Time episode, where they realize that if they go back in time using the phone booth after they're done with their report, they can leave themselves clues and props and traps and things that they can then get themselves out of a jam, basically by thinking about what they're going to do in the future. When they can come back in time.
Such clever writing. Because if you and I had open access to his time machine, I could turn to you and say, hey, make sure you tell me to leave a gun in this trash can. Oh, okay, no problem. And then I should be able to reach in the trash can and get it. Because we have access to a time machine. It's funny in the context of the movie because it should be more complicated. But it's not. Really?
It's not.
If you want to talk about the science of time travel, it's not it's not more complicated than that.
Yeah. And it brings up, you know, obviously some really interesting philosophical questions, you know, which brings me to a point of contrast between these two movies, which is the difference in the way that the time continuum manifests itself. To me, there are three kinds of time travel movies. Longtime listeners will have heard me say this before, but, you know, there are closed loop time travels where everything that was going to have happened has already happened and nothing that you can do can change anything, and you can only end up doing things that make what you were trying to stop happened in the first place. There are alternate future ones, which is kind of what Back to the Future is, where you go back and you change something and now the new future that you go back to is different than the one that you left. And then there are ones where the universe is kind of self-correcting in a way. Like, the whole point of Back to the Future is that he has to be active to get his parents back together again. But there's a sense in which he has changed the past enough such that his parents are now going to have a slightly different relationship than they would have before, which means, not to be too crude about it, but it's going to affect their love life in some way or another, which means that the exact combination of egg and sperm that made Marty and his brother and his sister is very unlikely to actually happen again in the future.
Right. Even if he delayed their copulation by an hour, then you've already changed
a millisecond. Right, exactly.
You've already changed so much. It's like the opposite of the butterfly effect. If you truly believe in the butterfly effect theory, then Back to the Future must give you a migraine. Like, it would drive you
in. Right. Well, so, yeah. A lot of time travel movies explain that away by saying that, like, the universe, through some unexplained sort of thing, has, like, a course correction built into it in somehow or another, where, like, the universe wants to get back to where it's supposed to be. And so when you change something, you know, the right things end up happening. Now, of course, this movie doesn't, you know, Back to the Future doesn't really, like, actually succeed at that, because a whole lot of stuff does change about the future. Biff is now his father's employee instead of his father's boss, and, you know, various other things that have changed in the future. They're rich instead of poor. But Marty is still Marty, and his brother and sister are now different. You know, his brother now has a nice job, but it's still his brother. So it doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It does. It's thematically it does. But
yeah.
My question to you was going to be, if you and I went back in time and kidnapped Joan of Arc, Abraham Lincoln, Genghis Khan, and only for like 6 hours and then brought them back,
right,
would they not tell of their tale?
Well, so that's the interesting thing about Bill and Ted and the time travel rules that it establishes, because Bill and Ted is absolutely a closed loop movie. And you know this from very, very early on, because they meet themselves. Their future selves come back and meet their past selves and give them some advice and whatever else. And we are with the past selves characters at that point in the scene. And then later on in the movie, two-thirds of the way through, we have traveled through enough of the story that we are now the people that came back from the future to talk to themselves. And we see it from their perspective. And the scene plays out the exact same way. And he tells him, don't forget to wind your watch. And he still forgets to wind his watch. And so the whole thing is done in this way that everything is a closed loop. And everything that, you know, again, everything that's going to have happened, happened. Which implies a couple of things. One is that Rufus knows that this plan is going to succeed. Because one of the questions that I had is a problem with a lot of time travel movies, which is you have a time machine, you can go back to any time. Why would you go back to 2 days before this project is due instead of like 2 months before the project is due, when Bill and Ted can have a whole lot of time, you know, instead of having this ticking clock happening where they have to get all this stuff quickly.
Also, on that same note, just to interject this, if you have access to a time machine, there are no stakes because you can go back multiple times until you get it right.
Well, they solve that a little bit in this movie and they hand wave it away. But he says to them, the clock is always running in San Dimas. Like, whatever it is that they do, like, their reality somehow or another is always sort of moving forward. And so they have this ticking clock because they're present in their subjective time, at least. Their presentation is going to be... So maybe like the phone booth has a sense of when now is. And so when they leave and go back into the past and then they come back, they're coming back to whatever now would have been in that same amount of time passing.
Oh. Wow.
But, you know, going back to this idea of the closed loop and the question that you asked originally, which is, you know, can they change the past? Well, so two things. One is that, again, I think Rufus came back to when he came back to because he knew that it was going to work. Because he knows the story of Bill and Ted, and this is probably part of the legend of Bill and Ted 1,000 years in the future, is, oh, somebody came back from traveling back in time and helped them finish their history report. And so, like, he knows that the mission is going to succeed before he even does it, which I think is cool. But the second thing is that because it's a closed-loop time machine, it implies that they went back and got Billy the Kid and Sigmund Freud and Abraham Lincoln. And then those people went back, and in our timeline, in the timeline of Bill and Ted, like, Abraham Lincoln was a time traveler, and he just kind of didn't tell, you know, like, they were told, don't tell anybody about this, or, you know, it might change history or something like that. Or maybe they told it to a few close friends. But, you know, it implies that, like, all of these people actually were time travelers and have always been time travelers, because Bill and Ted were always going to go back and pluck them from their time.
Right. I could see that next on Ancient Aliens. Were Joan of Arc and Abraham Lincoln time travelers? A movie from 1989 says maybe.
Yeah. Which, let's talk about these secondary characters a little bit, yep, too, because I love every one of them. Like, you know, they're so broad and they're so, you know, they are one note in a way.
Who's your favorite?
At the same time, they're all the perfect. I mean, I love all of them, but I love Billy the Kid. I love all of them, dude. I love Billy the Kid. I love Billy the Kid's relationship with Socrates, you know, as kind of the first ones. I love Abraham Lincoln. You know, I love Sigmund Freud and his sort of like, I love the way they're all kind of agog at the way the future is and just, I don't know.
Joan of Arc.
They have that same sort of wide-eyed innocence. I love Napoleon.
Long-time action character actor Al Leong plays Genghis Khan. You'd know Al. He's also in Die Hard. My favorite is probably just because it was a real crush on 17-year-old me. I love Diane Franklin as one of the two princesses. She's just adorable. And as an actor, you could tell she's just really gets the vibe of the movie and is having fun.
Yeah. And, you know, again, they all played him, I think, perfectly because they played them that in a way that feels true to this world. You know, the world that we're living in, the world of Bill and Ted, like it feels like that's and they all just kind of go along with it. You know, but they don't, but in a way that you just buy because I think because of the acting, you know,
It's just playful. I mean, this is Stephen Herrick. He had directed before this Critters and, you know, would later go on to have much bigger successes with like Mr. Holland's Opus. But back in the day, Stephen Herrick made just be popcorn fun.
He was a very journeyman director kind of person. He's had a wide range of stuff.
Yeah, but he made fun popcorn movies like Critters and Bill and Ted. Come on, you kidding? That's good stuff.
So here's an interesting question. Did Lincoln find out what was going to happen to him when he was in the future? And if so, like, you can almost, again, getting back to that, it fascinates me so much that I want to get back to it. But like, I love this idea that maybe Abraham Lincoln found out that he was going to be assassinated. And went back and still walked into that theater knowing that he was going to be assassinated because he knew that he couldn't change the future. And there's something very like, you can imagine Abraham Lincoln, the real Abraham Lincoln, being the kind of person who would do that.
Or,
you know,
or in the Bill and Tediverse, perhaps he was made aware of his impending demise and avoided the theater and went on to unite the country in wonderful ways that we never could imagine.
Well, but then it would mean that the Bill and Ted-iverse was not the universe, was not our universe at the beginning of the story because he can't change history. We established that. One of the other interesting things about this that I never noticed in all of the hundreds of times that I have watched this movie that I never thought about, there is that meeting at the Circle K. Strange things are afoot at the Circle K, which is another one of those lines that we repeated endlessly when I was a teenager.
No, you talk about stuff we used to quote. What's up, Missy? I mean, Mom.
Yeah. Yeah. Another one that because they repeat that a couple times in the movie and it gets funnier every time. No, but they meet themselves at the Circle K and they realize that they only have a very little limited amount of time left and they have to, you know, get back to be able to deliver this report. They could have just let all of the people off of at that point, they had collected everybody. Right? Their future versions, the older versions, had collected all of the people that they needed for their history report. They could have just left them there with their younger versions and said, all right, now you guys have a day to plan your presentation. Go ahead and, you know, get to it.
Yeah.
But then it hurts your brain to realize, like, if they had done that, then their past selves would never have gone back.
It would have precluded.
In the past to get them, all those people.
It would have precluded or prevented the other events. Yes.
Right, which then would have led to a paradox, which means that they can't, like, again, in closed loop time theology, that can't ever happen. So,
well, these are all questions that we can ask Bill and Ted screenwriter Ed Solomon, because he has agreed to sit down with us and have a chat about the time travel machinations of Excellent Adventure, Bogus Journey, and the upcoming Bill and Ted Face the Music, which
I am not going to ask him anything about that because I don't want to know anything about it.
Oh, no. Whatever.
I'm going to put my fingers in my ears of the interview.
No, I just said writer of. I don't think we're going to be discussing part three, and that's fine with me if we don't at all. I'm fine.
So I want to just go down a quick list of scientific and or logical difficulties that the movie has. Everything looks old in the past, right? So we're used to seeing, like, if you go to, like, a frontier town in 2020 or in 1985 – or 89, it looks old because it's 100 years old. But if you went back 100 years into the past when it was new, it would look new. Same thing with like a castle. If you went back to a castle when that castle, you know, wasn't 400 years old.
It wouldn't look like ruins. It would look like a brand new castle.
It would look like a brand new castle. You know, but of course they have to shoot at an actual castle. And so like, they're not going to build a brand new looking castle when they can just go shoot at an old castle. So, but at the same time, again, this part of it gives the movie sort of part of its charm. Along those same sort of lines, the princesses in the 15th century would not have been speaking a version of English that would have been easy to, you know, it wouldn't sound like they sounded the movie, and it would be probably somewhat challenging to communicate with them. I mean, we're talking about, you know, Shakespearean language here. Interesting point of fact, Sigmund Freud, I looked this up. So one of the things that I like about this movie is that they don't have the characters that wouldn't have spoken English speak English. Genghis Khan doesn't speak English. Joan of Arc doesn't speak English. Socrates doesn't speak English. And I think that adds a lot of the charm to this sort of thing.
Can you – no, Stephen, you're absolutely right, but can you pronounce his name right?
Sorry, I mean Socrates would not have been able to speak English. And I love that they didn't make him, and Napoleon doesn't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
Which in an earlier version of the script, you know, maybe we should save this for our interview with him, but I've been told that in the earlier version of the script, that was supposed to be Hitler.
Good God.
And they decided that that was a bridge too far. So we have to put a pin in that and remember to ask him about it, because I'm sure it's a great story. But Sigmund Freud, fun fact, did actually speak English. He was fluent in 8 languages. And so, you know, I looked it up immediately because I was like, wait, why is Freud speaking English? So, the screenwriters did their research. They knew that none of these other characters spoke English, but that Sigmund Freud actually could communicate with them in English.
Ed Solomon and Chris Matheson co-wrote this. They're longtime collaborators. And like Back to the Future is, you can imagine that this thing was polished and rewritten and finessed to make the time travel paradoxes both logical but also fun.
Right. And it all works. Scientifically, last 2 things.
Yep.
There would not have been cavemen in California in 1 million BC. There weren't even humans in 1 million BC. And what, you know, eventually became humans were all in Africa.
Okay.
And then Napoleon, there's a, you know, a running gag in the movie about this water park called Waterloo. And that's where they end up finding Napoleon, which is a funny visual, and it's a great scene. Like, Napoleon ends up loving going at this water park. They realize that that must be where Napoleon had went, but that doesn't really sort of track, because Waterloo is the scene of Napoleon's most famous defeat, which, number one, when they pluck him from time, he's still a military commander. After Waterloo, he was exiled and never commanded an army again. So clearly he would not have been to Waterloo yet at that point, or wouldn't have fought the battle at Waterloo. And if he had, would you want to go to a place that was named after literally like the worst day of your life?
No, I think if we want to extrapolate this much logic, okay, perhaps he saw Waterloo and it was literally one of the only words he recognized or understood as a location?
Possibly, but Waterloo is not in France. It's in Belgium.
You're in Belgium.
And, like, the reason why he lost at Waterloo is because he was trying to conquer it. So it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't a place in his country at the time. I could be wrong about that. I'm not a historian. But
no, I think more so that it was, hey, wouldn't it be funny if Napoleon was obsessed with a water park and then somebody went, oh, my God, call it Waterloo. And they went, yes, that's all. All right. What does it say, Stephen, about both movies? The time machines are outdated relative. I mean, the DeLorean was completely obscure and out of date by then. But phone booths were not. Phone booths were very prevalent in 1989, but would soon be out of date and obscure. What is it about antiquated or old technology that makes it funny that's the time machine?
I don't know, man. We love like steampunky kind of things, and that's that same sort of thing. It's like that
the mundane. Yeah.
The future, the imagining what the future would look like from the past. I mean, it almost had to be, right? Like the idea of this telephone booth that they all have to sort of pack into, and the mechanics of they have to look through a phone book to dial the numbers, like, oh, let's go to ancient Greece. Beep, 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 beep. Speaking of which, you know, in this case, the time machine can clearly move explicitly in space as well as time, because they can go to ancient Greece, they can go to Mongolia, which begs the question, could they go to, like, Venus in that thing? I don't know.
Yeah, but they couldn't open the door, probably. Aside from the size constraints, that's a pretty handy and clever time travel machine.
Well, it's great, you know, and I love...
You got the phone, you got the book, you got the antenna on top, which is, I think, an umbrella. And it holds 2 relatively comfortably, but and that joke just gets so funny, because by the end it's like, how many could you fit in there?
Yeah, the more, like, every time they fit one more person in it just gets funnier and funnier.
Yep.
And then that scene where they're like, they're riding it like a canoe through the time circuits, because they can't all fit in it anymore. They have to open the door and sit, you know, horizontally in it so that they can all actually travel through time in it. I don't know. I love everything about this movie. I love the effects that are just on the borderline of being cheesy, but in exactly the right way. The performances from both main and supporting cast. This movie is the definition of an A++++ for me. It is one of my favorite movies of all time. It holds up every bit as much as I hoped that it would. It is scientifically, surprisingly, especially the time travel mechanic. I love the time travel mechanic is consistent. There are almost no plot holes in the way that they use time travel in ways that there are, in Back to the Future. And they eat pudding out of metal cans, which is a thing that, like, I look back on with this weird sort of fondness of, you know, eating the pudding, and it kind of tastes a little bit like the metal in the metal can. And it just puts me back to my childhood in all of the best ways.
Yep.
So I love this movie. I think these are the two best time travel comedies of all time, and it was a joy to revisit them this week.
Great. I firmly agree. They're both ridiculously fun, and I think my favorite thing about Bill and Ted is that it seems like a clever, kind of raucous, irreverent comedy, but then when it gets to the end and it starts to be about Bill and Ted and their future and their music and what they're going to be, it becomes weirdly poignant. It becomes a little bit touching, and
I got a little teary.
Yep, in a sincere way, not just in a, well, let's give everybody a happy ending, because it's easy right to give us a happy ending. That's easy. But to have it end with a little bit of real heart is
that moment when they realize, wait a second, if we're going to succeed at this, we need to actually work at it. You know, is a great moment.
Yeah, and that their music will eventually mean something. They're not nobodies. They're not worthless slackers. Right. They might be a little slow, or they might be a little behind everyone else, but they have their place in the world, and theirs happens to be very important. Right. And it just has, like I said, it's a little more poignant than you would expect from just a raucous slacker boys comedy. And I don't mean, I mean, yeah.
But then they launch into that song with every bit of as much exuberance as they had at the beginning of the movie, that playing terrible music. And you get that wry smile from Rufus to close out the movie.
And Bill and Ted are one of my favorite duos. I just love them. I like how they love each other. I give it an A. I love it. I love it. It was so much fun to revisit. And maybe in the future, we'll do Back to the Future 2 versus Bogus Journey, and then Back to the Future 3 versus Face the Music when that comes out. Because I want to revisit all of these movies. They're just so much fun. And it is such a joy to revisit something. It's like, you know, a lot of times revisiting an old movie from the 80s or 90s is like welcoming back an old friend you haven't seen in 20 years. And for the first 10 or 15 minutes, you're like, is this still a person I have anything in common with? Is this still a person I respect? Are they going to drop a racial epithet? Or are they going to say some political garbage that makes me cringe? And then after like 20 minutes, you're like, nope, it's that old friend I still love. And both of these movies are like that old friend you still love. So thank you for listening. We will be back with two movies soon. Hopefully crappier movies, because it's kind of fun when we don't like a movie. I'm tired of all this kumbaya crap.
For us, maybe, but... No.
Like Steven said, it was a real joy to revisit these movies, and we hope that you will do the same, and thanks for listening.
Thank you guys for listening, and as always, if you'd like to support the show, patreon.com/ScottEWeinberg. Thanks again, and we'll see you soon.